Hello, everybody. Charles Eisenstein here for our first live call for Masculinity, A New Story. And I'm here with Boysen Hodgson, who most of you, many or most of you probably heard our recorded conversation, and we're here live. Hello, Boysen.
Hi, Charles. Great to be with you.
Yeah, so I'm going to spend a little bit of time first just going through some of the questions that came up, and I might send some of them over to you, Boysen, when I just have no clue at all what is what to say. But a lot of them I do have some ideas, so I'm going to spend we'll spend maybe 20 or 30 minutes going through some of the things that have come up on the forums, and then we'll see what's alive right now, and we'll turn on the mics. Turn the mic so you can ask either or both of us questions in real time. And I'll say that the pot is stirring now, and a lot of the issues that I expected to come up have come up, and a lot of the issues that I didn't expect to come up are also coming up. So I'm just going to go through a few of the things here. The first one is from Alex. And it's about being male with a physical affliction. So he said, I've been battling with a prolapsed disc in my spine for a few years now, and I struggle to find my masculinity when I can't be in service to materiality in a physical sense. It makes me feel like a failure as an archetypal man, pathetic and useless. It drives me to be more feminine, as I know this is achievable in my condition, but there's no substance there, no anchor. So please, how can I be the strong, sturdy, supportive man I want to be when I feel physically weak and unsupported? So I think I'm just going to probably give voice to what Alex and probably all of us know, which is that obviously the kind of strength we're talking about here doesn't depend on being able to use your physical muscles. For me, one of the most inspiring kinds of strength is when someone has suffered setbacks, is maybe in physical pain, someone who I would say, wow, that person's life has been shattered, yet they're still optimistic, they're still kind, they're still not in a victim story, they're still positive. They still have the capacity to listen to me. Like that's a kind of strength that is unconditional. You know, it doesn't, because all of us, I mean, what Alex is experiencing, every single one of us is going to experience someday. If not through an illness or an accident, then in old age, you know, there's going to be a time in life where on a physical level we are helpless, just as we were when we were born. We're going to be helpless. But that doesn't mean that we can't be masculine, or it doesn't mean we can't have any other quality. So, I mean, I could even see that, I guess this is true for me even, that difficulties and setbacks, they kind of give me an opportunity to be strong for real. But I do understand that society definitely, I mean, it's offering so many you know, messages and comparisons and judgments that if you're in a wheelchair, then, well, you're not very manly. And I think also, I guess I'll say one other thing, like to the extent that, you know, femininity is associated with being receptive, I think that injuries and illnesses, they are maybe an opportunity to embrace that as well and to receive, because obviously when we're talking about masculinity, masculinity can only be, can only flourish if femininity is flourishing as well, both within and without. Anyway, I hope that's helpful. And if you have follow-up on that, you can kind of jot that down. And when we open the mics, you can follow up. And Boysen, if there's anything really bubbling in you, then you're welcome to chime in.
I think that what you just said at the very end there, Charles, is kind of, you know, strong masculinity, strong femininity. It's a rising tide. My hope and intention is that both aspects of all of us are going to be growing at the same time. So,
yeah. And later in the call, we're going to get, there's a lot of discussion on the forums about binaries and stuff.
Yes.
So I'm going to get to that later. Saving the juiciest for last. Well, actually, it just happened that they came in that order. But anyway, the next question was, what are your thoughts on competitions among men and maybe also among women? From Aaron, sometimes I think that low self-esteem and the feeling of not being masculine enough are just the result of comparison in regard to obviously old stereotypes. But then the question is, how can we compete in a healthy way? What could be the new story behind that? I mean, this has come to me through my work in economics as well. Being wary of an excessive counter-reaction to a hyper-competitive economy and a hyper-competitive understanding of masculinity. And by the way, those two things go together. Money and patriarchy arose at the same time. But so to counter-react, you know, to completely reject everything that masculinity was, including competition. So for me, I thought about, like, what is the most beautiful aspect of competition? In my life, it illuminates weaknesses that I didn't know I had. And shows me what's possible. And sometimes, you know, without competition, I might never be able to see that in myself. Also, competition helps refine the direction of my gifts. So, you know, how do you know who is the person best suited to perform some function, you know, well, I don't know. I guess this is starting to sound a little artificial. I was thinking more in economic terms. Like, you can look at competition in a way that's not about squashing the other guy, but it's a mutual display that illuminates something in everybody who's competing. Like, for example, one thing that, like one question that I have found answered in competition. I'm reaching back here to my days as an athlete. But what does it take me to quit? What does it take for me to quit? Like, what causes that? What happens at that moment when I quit? Not as a matter of shame, but as a matter of illumination. Oh, now I understand myself better. Or am I really as good at the thing that I think I'm good at? Am I really that good at it? Or am I just deluding myself? What are my strengths? What are my weaknesses? Because competition can be a path to self-knowledge. And either I can develop the things that I've discovered need attention, which we might call weaknesses, or I can turn my strengths, I can inhabit what really are my strengths and apply them. And maybe I discover that, you know, I'm not really cut out for the shot put. Maybe I should, you know, run the mile instead. And I wouldn't maybe have known that if I hadn't competed in the shot put. This is a somewhat fanciful example, but you know what I mean. And I guess even, you know, even sports and these kind of artificial contained competition, I mean, some people say, well, that, you know, gives expression to that energy which would otherwise go toward violence. I don't really buy that one because there's, you could equally say that it's practice for violence. You know, I don't think that soccer hooligans are any less violent because they have this outlet of football, you know. So, but I do think that much of what is brought through competition can also happen in a safely contained environment. So, Boyden, if you have anything to add to that, feel free. Otherwise, I will move on.
I muted myself. Oh, I'm okay. Here.
Okay.
The other thing that I would just throw into the mix is that isn't what comes up for me is this idea of play. And competitive play is a place where I have learned competition always seemed very frightening and dangerous to me as a young man and as a boy. It was something that terrified me, and the kind of hyper-masculine competitive thing, world of sports, you know, the gladiator of football in the United States, still I don't really understand it. And with the work that I've done with men, exploring ideas of competition through play, where it really is mutual encouragement, finding the best in each other, you know, finding the best in myself, being one step better than I was yesterday at whatever it is that I'm doing, and then also holding other men in that same space or holding other women in that same space. And I have that experience every day with my daughters, with my girls, mm-hmm. of encouraging them to, you know, kind of keep that accepting and loving self competition going for their own improvement. I think that there is a value in that kind of exploration, and I find it most through play these days.
You know, listening to that just came to me. There's something about a relentless opponent that is irreplaceable. Someone that you know isn't going to cut you some slack if you start whining and crying, like maybe mommy did, you know. But they're just, you know, there is no pity there. You can't manipulate them in any way. So you're really, and this is, you're really kind of, you know, left to your own devices, your own resourcefulness. And it's very much like an encounter with materiality. I mean, maybe that's why people skydive, you know, or climb cliff faces, because the cliff isn't going to cut you some slack if you have a lapse of intention or care. I even appreciated this very much when I was working in construction 6 years ago. Like, you know, I had to, if I was on a ladder or using a table saw or something like that, there was like a mercilessness about it. And I think putting yourself in competition also brings out some of that.
I love that. Yeah, I absolutely love that. And there is an absolute confrontation with the real.
Yes.
With exactly what is right now. Did I clear that bar or did I not clear that bar? Mm-hmm. That I think is incredibly helpful for human development, just to be able to, you know, put markers on, to be able to measure. And then it's about the healthy acceptance of what is.
That's right.
And being able to work with that in an effective way. And I think that's the community part. Like that's where being with others helps me look at reality, see what is, and then accept where I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Beautiful red-tailed hawk in my backyard.
I'm going to skip forward to one that's related about parenting here, because that just came up. This is from Audie. The part of your conversation that resonated the most with me concerns parenting. So you kind of quoted what we were saying, boys, in our conversation. You can push against me as hard as you want to, and I will still be there. And I'm not going to hurt you. I'm not going to hurt myself. I'm not going to collapse into self-pity or victimhood. And then I commented, but you said something like that, and I said that I felt an almost tragic lack of training in how to do that.
Mm.
So Audie says that sentence really jumped out at him. So he says, here's my situation. I have no children of my own, but I'm married to someone who has an 8-year-old boy from a previous marriage. We've been together 5 years, recently married. And when my stepson is having a meltdown or is pushing against us as hard as he wants to, those are difficult times for me. Because what's going on in my head is, stop being such a jerk. You're making such a huge deal about a small thing. And you shouldn't talk or act that way towards us, especially toward your mother, who loves you more than you can possibly comprehend, and who, by the way, is my wife. And so I have issues with you yelling at her like that, and even occasionally throwing things or trying to hit her, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And my wife is much better at responding to those situations by saying to him, essentially, I know you're having a hard time. Come give me a hug. And sometimes it takes him a while, but he always comes around. And the two of them end up all lovey-dovey, and he's back to his normal, charming, empathic self. But my wife and I are not quite on the same page on this. She thinks her way is right, and it obviously works, at least eventually. But I wonder if sometimes it's giving him the wrong message, that his acting out in these ways just gets him a loving embrace from his mother. And I know that I could do better in terms of compassion reaching out, but I wonder if there's a middle ground. And relevant to this forum, if that middle ground contains a healthy blend of the masculine from me and the feminine from her. That is, the sturdy, hey, we don't talk to each other that way message from me, and the okay now, come here and give me a hug. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I have a couple things to say about this, and as a father of 4 children, I have some experience. So I think that, you know, you can push against me as hard as you want and I won't hurt you. That doesn't mean that I will let you have your way, or that I will, you know, indulge whatever acting out you're doing. It could be in the form of what I do is I look my, you know, my 3-year-old now is doing stuff like this sometimes. You know, I look him right in the face and I say, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and I just hold his gaze and I say it with seriousness, you know, and it gives him pause. I can't say that it works every time, but I feel like if I lose it, if I lose my temper, then he actually has less of a feeling of safety and less of a feeling that I'm solid.
Yeah.
Than if I and if I you know, let him have his way, he'd have the same feeling. Both of those reactions, because they're reactivity, don't give him the feeling that I'm rock solid. And this reminds me of a teaching story I heard by Milton Erickson. He was he was kind of the founder of hypnotherapy, and he was just this extraordinary, extraordinary psychiatrist in the mid-20th century. So he tells a story. He says he was, you know, in the living room, quiet evening, and his daughter, who was 3 years old, wanted his mother's attention, wanted Erickson's wife's attention, and she was reading a magazine, and so the daughter came and grabbed the magazine and threw it on the floor. And Milton Erickson said, I don't know, Sophie, please give that magazine back to your mother. She was reading it. You can't do that. And she said, I don't want to. So he took her upstairs to the bedroom and sat with her in the bed and just hung out there. And pretty soon she wanted to go back downstairs where all other kids were having a good time. So she tries to get out of bed, and he won't let her. He holds on to her. And she says, Daddy, let go of me. And he says, I don't want to. And then, you know, she struggles, and then she starts kicking and screaming. But no matter what she does, he, with complete calm, with in a placid way, says, I don't want to. I don't want to. And finally, after a long time, I mean, she's really testing his will, you know, trying everything, you know, tears and pleading and et cetera, et cetera. She says, oh, no, it's not I don't want to. It's I don't has to. Sorry about that. Messed up the story. Pick up that magazine. I don't has to. So she's asking him, I don't has to. And he says, I don't has to. Let me go, Daddy. I don't has to. I don't has to. And then finally she says to him, okay, I'll give Mommy her magazine back. And he says to her, you don't has to. And then she stops. And she says, but I wants to. And only then does he let her go. And that, to me, was a beautiful illustration of, I don't know whether to call it fatherhood or just good parenting. I think everyone has something to learn from that. But I think that that story kind of speaks for itself, so I don't want to analyze it too much, but that story carries a resonance to me. I don't have to. Boys, would you like to add anything?
Wonderful. I could expand that into, I connect that immediately to the idea of initiation and why did we do rites of passage? Why do we do rites of passage? And there is the distinction. I don't has to, I want to. The fitting into society, the fitting in. And on the bigger kind of parenting question, I think there's a connection here to competition. And I notice myself, you know, when I want to win one of these encounters, I'm done. That's it. Nope. Mm-hmm. Step aside, step out of the way. It's not a competition, you know, it's my job, my role somehow to be the tree, to be the mountain. You can push on me, and I'm not going to move, and I'm also not going to push back. You know, I'm not going to try and win this whatever is happening in the moment. And I think that what the person who is writing said, I think that there is a place for that very healthy embrace of both the, you know, what we're calling quote masculine, what we're calling quote feminine, in holding a boundary and learning to draw a clear boundary and learning to draw boundaries with open arms. You know, I love you and no. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, that is very common for me. That comes out of my mouth a lot. I love you and no, you may not do that. I love you and that will have consequences.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's interesting. I love you and no. I've also been encountering that concept among people who are working with femininity and trying to find alternatives to the shaming no that often, the shame that often accompanies turning down a male advance, which is a pretty powerful experience for many men, including myself, you know, when you finally get up the courage to, you know, ask for a woman's phone number or ask her out on a date, you know, or basically you're in some way saying, I'm attracted to you. And she makes kind of a face and with disdain, you know, says, like she's offended, you know, and like the feeling of smallness, of shame, of humiliation is so intense. I've had a couple conversations with women who describe it, this alternative approach that basically says, wow, I'm really flattered and no.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that's, you know, they, and it's almost like an energetic thing. Anyway, the other thing that's coming up, boys, and as you're talking about, you know, defending a boundary and it not excuse me a second. Defending a boundary and it not being about defeating somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's not about domination, this thing. And that plays into the conversation that was happening on the forum about warrior.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is this, people are asking, why is this warrior so commonly invoked as a male archetype? I mean, doesn't that mean, I mean, isn't that about going to war? Isn't it about fighting? Isn't that all about defeating an enemy? And isn't that, like, don't we want to get away from that? And then, of course, people will say, well, you know, it's the qualities of the warrior that we're looking for, the inner warrior, the warrior of the heart, the qualities of discipline and presence and awareness and strength and fortitude and staying on purpose and all that kind of stuff. And the way what came to me is that it's not about defeating the enemy as the main goal. It's not fighting against something, but it's fighting for something. And like you said, maintaining a boundary, a proper boundary. So it's maybe, and I don't know, like this isn't, I'm not like, I don't feel like I'm like channeling from source at this moment, but then this has been coming up in a lot of these conversations. It is about service and being ready to do whatever is necessary to maintain the sacred boundary.
Yes. Yes. In service of what?
Yeah.
And I think that, and knowing what you're in service to is kind of key to this. And I have in my work with the Mankind Project over, you know, the last 10 years, I've heard this from within the Mankind Project, from without the Mankind Project, from in the culture, just over and over and over. Why warrior? Why warrior? Why do you call this thing the new warrior? We have to get rid of the warrior. We have to, like, all of this kind of, you know, we have to, and there's an interesting distinction. So, oh, we have to defeat the warrior? We have to destroy the warrior? It's an interesting conundrum brought just by that paradox. And I haven't found a better word, you know, for talking about archetypes. We're talking about something that is archetypal. I love the kind of modified, the marked up words, the peaceful warrior, the warrior of the heart, the, you know, the new warrior, as we use. I love all of that. And yet there is something distinctly valuable to me in having a frame of reference, a metaphorical frame of reference to look at and examine and how I am embodying a particular kind of archetype, and I can use that as a reference. So it's a useful tool, not a defined thing set in time or place, right? It's a part of the story, and the story is changing.
Yeah. And I think that one thing I often say is that I'm not categorically rejecting the idea of a fight.
Mm.
It's that we are in a habit of fighting in this civilization. We see everything as a fight. And therefore, we use the methods of a fight and the mentalities of fighting in situations that cannot be resolved by fighting.
Mm-hmm.
Probably there's very few situations where fighting is appropriate. But I can't say that they don't exist.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we are assailed by things. And perhaps even the techniques that we've learned about fighting are less effective than kind of Tai Chi techniques.
Yeah.
But still... I mean, did I talk about the Aurora theater shootings in this course yet? Can't remember.
I don't remember you speaking about Aurora, no.
Yeah, well, there was one of the theater shootings a number of years ago where the guy just walked in during the premiere of Batman and just opened fire
mm-hmm.
and killed 13 or 15 people.
Yep.
Four of them were men who died because they interposed themselves in front of their girlfriends to take the bullet. Like, that's a kind of extreme example of defending the perimeter, defending the boundary. But it felt like a warrior action to me. Sometimes extreme situations bring out something essential.
I know folks in Newtown, Connecticut, where the Sandy Hook massacre took place, and their response to, so, and this is a warrior response, but it's the Tai Chi, as you said. So, you know, their response to this is love wins.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Newtown strong, love wins. And like, that has been the mantra that has carried the last name of the family, I think, is Bradley. No, that's not right, but close. Has carried the, you know, protests for saner gun laws, has carried the, you know, looking right. at, and the people of Newtown, Sandy Hook, they didn't respond by saying, we want cops in our schools, we want more guns, we need to be safer, we need to be more protected.
Mm-hmm.
Love wins.
Yeah, and we're seeing this now in the response to the terror attacks in Paris, where the kind of mainstream response that's all the politicians are parroting, and the mainstream media, they're basically, you know, their warrior response is bomb them, invade them, boots on the ground, you know, retaliate, revenge. What I would call, maybe if you want to use the word warrior, you know, maybe the harder thing to do, like, is is to withstand the assault of that temptation and to stay aligned with the world that we want to create, a world that's not an endless cycle of vengeance and retaliation, where you can take an insult, you can take an injury, you can take anything that comes at you, you can take a child yelling at you, a child throwing things, and you don't strike back.
Mm-hmm.
You don't strike back at the expression of the pain, but you hold steady. You don't lose it. You don't contribute to the cycle of violence. You hold steady. And you look deeply at what's actually going on here. What's the origin of the pain? How can I serve healing here? How can I serve life? And that requires all of the capacities that we assign to the warrior.
Mm-hmm.
And you've got to be rock solid, you know? And it's not, I don't even think that that's something that we can achieve individually. Like, that's something that, but that's something that we can hold each other in.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Wonderful. Binaries. What was coming to me as you were speaking just now is, you know, there are some other binaries that we've been sold, and I'm just going to use that. We've been sold in the 20th century, in the 21st century, binaries about strength and weakness, about losing and winning, and good and bad in many of these things. And the warrior kind of gets tied to this so much, this kind of John Wayne warrior, you know, where...
Right.
Where the only good thing is your strength. The only good thing is winning the fight. The only good thing, you know, is to dominate.
Right. Whereas it takes even more strength to walk away from the fight.
Kung Fu. There's another show from the, you know, 70s, 80s. To take the hit and go back to the Christian zeitgeist. Go back to Jesus.
Right.
And
the
idea
of wimp, you know, or Gandhi.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Right. How much strength did it take? How much strength does it take? And how much warrior presence, presence does it take to not simply let the amygdala run your life?
Yeah.
And I think that is, you know, there's the lesson. Like, what part of my brain is making my decisions right now? And if it's midbrain, back brain making my decisions right now, then I need to listen up and do something differently, you know, create the space, as Eckhart Tolle would talk about, creating the space to feel into what's really happening.
So we have someone who's raised their hand here. So maybe let's, there's more questions I wanted to go through from the forums, but let's bring this person in and see what he or she has to add.
Hey, my name is Brady.
Hey.
And I've been an activist, kind of self-identified, I guess, or in the, I don't really like that word very much because it implies that other people are not activists. But
we know what you mean.
Yes, we gotcha.
Okay, cool. And I've grown up in a way that I've always kind of used my like mischievous nature and kind of also a little bit of rage for when I see people putting down women or objectifying them. Even through middle school, I was often gotten into fights with people about this. Like physical fights, and I kind of realized that's kind of a macho thing, you know, the macho solution to a problem that I see. And I've, you know, usually acted out of a place of kind of a mischievous nature, looking for trouble. It was what kept life exciting to me, and it still kind of fuels my work a little bit, like. I'm only really interested in direct action and things that are more disruptive in nature. And I question it all the time because what's really true for me is that I want to create a better future instead of consistently having this kind of destructive outlook. For example, if I see something wrong, I want to fight against it. And I've often ended up leading groups, and I fear sometimes, and it hinders me in being truly expressive with, you know, the things that I see happening. But when I'm unhindered, it ends up being an awesome action or a disruption or something, you know, and people are inspired and empowered, and it's great. But you know, it's a big question for me whether being disruptive has a place in kind of this warrior that I'm trying to grow into as a somebody fighting for the earth and fighting for, you know, equality for women. And I guess it's kind of just a question that I have that I can't quite put into words.
Thank you.
That disruptive impulse sounds to me like it could be very much like the no, like the I love you, but no. Mm. It could also turn into no and I hate you. No and I'm so angry at you that I want to hurt you. And I'm gonna triumph over you and trample all over you, and you're going to have to abjectly, publicly humiliate yourself, and you're going to get what's coming to you. Like I often see that in activism as well, as well alongside, and it, often in the same person, alongside the benevolent, you know, I'm just taking a stand for what's good and beautiful and needs protection. You know, the will to dominate insinuates itself into even the most peaceful communication, I find. But but so there might be some of both in there, but I think there's definitely a place for the one who, you know, I mean, that takes courage, especially if there's a peer pressure, a social environment where it's acceptable or normal to disrespect women, you know, to be misogynistic, and you stand up for it and say, no, we're not doing that. That's not okay. Knowing that someone might come up and hit you, attack you, or put you down or exclude you. That needs to happen. And I guess, I mean, here again, it's like maybe that's the time where you know, it's time for a fight. But then fighting might become a habit as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, mm-hmm. but yeah, I don't, Boysen, you want to add anything to that?
Having trouble remembering the exact line, but there's a line in the Iron Hans story and in Lai's version, Iron John, about, you know, showing up to town and saying, what is it around here that a man's not supposed to do? Mm-hmm. So I hear a number of layers in there, and one of them is kind of just the longing for adventure, like, you know, excitement, the spice of life, getting and being engaged, and I resonate with that a lot. And the other part of this that I resonate with is I've never been a fighter. I've never been a real physical fighter, but I can humiliate people, and I have used words and my intellect and language and, you know, just to really make people feel bad about themselves. And that it's been a lesson for me to learn that that is just as that is an unhealthy, that does not create the relationships that I want, even in service to a higher good, even in service to a higher goal. Does it really serve me to make the people that I am pushing against feel badly about themselves, feel humiliated by what I'm doing? So in service to what is kind of the first question that I always come back to. And are there ways to refine how I approach people in the battles that I'm approaching, in the battles that I'm taking on, so that they leave, so that I'm not treating them without dignity, so that I'm treating the enemy, for lack of a better word, with dignity as I'm engaging? I think is, you know, it's hard for me today. It's hard for me even in my marriage. You know, that is one of my wife's things is, you know, patronizing, is please don't patronize me. You know, there are ways to get what we both want here without making each other feel badly about what's happening. So that's kind of what comes up for me. And then I think it is a role of the warrior just generally to disrupt. There's a disruptive kind of, you know, let's put people in cognitive dissonance, put people in the questioning the reality that they see.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up. Maybe we'll. There were a couple questions that were directed specifically to Boysen, and one that was directed to maybe both of us, but that I thought Boysen might have some experiences that could answer it. So I'm just going to kind of put all three of those out there, Boysen, and see what you're meant to talk about. There's one from Morgan. Where are the places that you've had or seen experiences of wholeness? What ways that you've seen these experiences to be more than a weekend workshop kind of thing that is massively inspiring, but doesn't then transition into the grind and loneliness of daily life? Like, that's one thing. And I'm just going to throw the other two out there. The other was, this, I guess, is related, how a boy becomes a man story. Acknowledging that this takes place over time, what is a successful versus an incomplete accomplishment of this?
Wonderful question.
Yeah, like those of us who don't feel like we've fulfilled our transformation story, how does that happen? What makes it successful? I mean, this is your work, you know, MKP. It's about how does a boy become a man? And and if you also, when you talk about that, if you also want to touch on the other question about about how MKP kind of segregates men and women into these separate groups. Isn't that part of the old story?
I'll deal with that one first because it's cool. There was a very wise man I know named Curtis Mitchell who stood up at the 25th anniversary for the Mankind Project, which was 6 years ago now, and read a poem about the reintegration of the masculine and feminine, read a piece of prose that he had written about the reintegration of the masculine and feminine. Bill Kauth, one of the founders of the New Warrior Training Adventure, his entire focus of work now is on creating community between men and women and building tribe, building a new story of tribe. I think that it's a complex, it's paradoxical, and I think that the Mankind Project is heading in a direction now that is much more collaborative and beginning to do that integration in an institutional way, in a way that I don't think that we were ready for. I don't think evolutionarily as an organization we were ready for it until now, and now I'm seeing it happen. So more and more trainings that are open to both men and women, more and more crossover groups being built with men and women. Just a lot more integration happening, and still trying to really, really hold our ground, hold our stand for safe and supportive and challenging spaces for men to do work, because that work is, there's so much of that work to be done for men to discover themselves, to heal shame, to be seen, to accept themselves as men, to be accepted by other men, to create relationships with men. There's so much of that work that I think is done really effectively in single gender groups, but then in service of what? So in service of bringing that energy, bringing that healed man back into the world in a way that he can be in collaboration with women and people in generally, so that I'm not encountering men in my life as competitors, but as collaborators, so that I'm not encountering women in my life as, some shadowy representation of the woman that rejected me 30 years ago or my mother or, whatever it is, so that I can be whole in that. So I think that's the first one, is I think there is more space, and I think that that's coming. I think Mankind Project is evolving. How do you know when the journey, so, and this is both in that wholeness, spaces of wholeness, and how do you know the transformation is done question, it's practice space. And, I've seen wholeness in the yoga studio. I've seen, deep experiences of wholeness in CrossFit gyms, for God's sake, if there's enough presence and self-awareness going into any activity, going into anything that I do in a community, I see those spaces for wholeness emerge, at Seder dinners at my friend Robert's house, where all of a sudden this just sweet, sweet, open-hearted happens, and the space of wholeness is there, where people are connected and people are interacting from that love, and people are, and then it goes away, and then we come back to it, and then it goes away, and then we come back to it. And so I think it is that ongoing practice, and then the transformation, am I done? No, I'm not done. I've done some big work. I've done some hero's journeys. I've taken on some intense weekend workshops. I've taken on the longer practices, and I don't know that, I wake up knowing that I am who I am, and I wake up knowing what I'm in service to, and I have it much more readily accessible that I can go back to source. I can go back to what brings me wholeness, and every day is more a part of that transformative process of submission and will being exerted in equal force. Hmm. Yeah. Acceptance and activity.
The question of why have single gender groups at all It's related to the discussions that have been coming up around binaries.
Yeah.
And, you know, why have a course on masculinity? Why not have a course on humanity? And I'm going to, I've been doing some reading recently that sheds some light on it for me, but let me just first go into the comments here. Why binary? Are we limiting ourselves? So the basic theme is, are we limiting ourselves by defining certain traits as masculine and some as feminine? One thing that that came to me is that perhaps it's not that some traits are masculine and some are feminine, but that each trait can be expressed in a masculine or feminine way. I mean,
beautiful.
We certainly have like the warrior archetype. There's a feminine aspect to it too, like the angry mama bear, you know?
Hell yeah.
Like you cannot say that you know, that fighting is, you know, a uniquely male trait. I mean, my God, like women just totally lose it if they think that their child is threatened. You know, they become like the most ferocious creature in existence. And perhaps that's true for all of these, all of these traits. So I was reading this. I'm reading this book. I just started it called Aphrodite's Daughters, and I wish I had it in front of me, so I could remember the author's name. But you can look it up, Aphrodite's Daughters, and she's this woman spent a lot of time in India. And she's drawing in part on Hindu mythology that describes the origin of the binaries, which is basically that God was just being. It wasn't male or female. It was all that there was. But then God decided that it would be really awesome to love and be loved, to touch and be touched, to know and be known. So God split God's self into two, one of which was Shakti, one was Shiva. One was materiality and energy and flesh and form, and the other was awareness and spirit and something abstract, and I'm probably mangling this a little bit, but became two. And then these two fell in love and gave birth to everything else. And interestingly, this is almost precisely the same as Taoism, which is something I have studied. You start with the wuji, the formless void. Wuji literally means without poles, without polarity. And then from that, it differentiates into the taiji, into the familiar symbol that we see, where these two poles differentiate, and then that gives birth to the 10,000 things. All things come from that. And so I find that, and so then the author of Aphrodite's Daughters says that having become separate, Eros arises, which is the desire to reunite. And this path back to wholeness is different for each of these two poles. And that doesn't change the underlying unity, but the path to that unity is very different. And the experience of being more or less at one of these poles, at a different space on the spectrum between these poles, is different. So that, you know, to me, it would be very arrogant to dismiss out of hand that way of understanding these polar energies, these binaries, to say, well, those were just kind of primitive superstitious people, or they were just elaborating some version of patriarchy, and we know better than that now. That kind of dismissing and discounting of other ways of knowing other cultures is itself an expression of patriarchy and is patronizing. So I guess that for people who are uncomfortable with even invoking qualities like masculine and feminine or the things that are associated with them, I'd like to offer that. And that doesn't to say that this is the only game we can play.
Yeah.
You know, there may be situations, in fact, I think there are many situations where looking at it through a lens of masculinity and femininity is just not useful, and it's distracting. And there are other lenses that might be non-binary or that might invoke other polar qualities that might be much more useful. So it's a lens, and I find it very useful in my life sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I would say as well. Is again, it's a framework, and I think that there's something patriarchal dominating, you know, dismissive about, you know, dismissing the or wanting to destroy, like literally destroy, the kind of cultural foundation and natural, you know, it's hard to say natural. Kind of what we see, what the story that we have observed in the universe for millennia since we woke up, since we had conscience.
And also to add a little bit more irony to it, these cultures were more matriarchal.
Yeah.
You know, the cultures in, I mean, this whole book is about, it's actually about women's sexual journeys, and she's pulling on kind of these ancient temples in India that have, I mean, these are 1,000-year-old temples that have really like highly erotic art that is celebrating female sexuality on that, you know, and these were, and she's digging into these traditions where women were not the objects and playthings of men, and their sexuality wasn't for the sole purpose of pleasuring men, but it was this radiant, you know, voluptuous celebration of life. And she's tracing some of the history about how that got shut down through the growth of patriarchy in India and especially the colonization of India. And the same thing is true of you know, ancient Taoist traditions. I mean, Confucianism was very patriarchal, but not Taoism. You know, it's drawing from really, really ancient times. And I'll say also that you know, it's hard to even say what a matriarchal culture is, because our understanding of an archy is itself colored by patriarchy. It's certainly not patriarchy with women inserted instead of men into the usual places. It's very, very different. But cultures that we could say are matriarchal, they also have single gender groups and a sexual division of labor to some extent. So I guess I just want to be really cautious about knowing too quickly. I want to, you know, and coming too quickly to an answer of, well, we just have to discard these binaries. Maybe we'll come to that. I don't think so, but maybe we will. And I'm not saying that the people who have been commenting on it are jumping too quickly to an answer, and I welcome this inquiry coming in. But, yeah. I mean, and then just to make it personal, for me, I guess one reason why I get intellectually exercised about it is that personally, there's like this deep wound of, do I get to be a man? Am I allowed to be a man? Is that okay? Is it okay to be a man? Because growing up in the 70s,
yeah,
sometimes that answer was no, as told to me by how can I put this? Told to me by some women's responses to the way that they were treated by men.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, I will never do that. I will never be a man like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that became, I will never be a man. And I'm not, even at this moment, I feel a little hesitant in saying, I want it to be okay to be a man. And like, it's almost like I say that and I get prepared for shaming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, well, you know, I want to be masculine. Like, is that okay? So maybe all of this intellectual stuff I've just been doing is really just a plea for permission, which I don't think can come from women, as a matter of fact. 'Cause that is where I took it, constantly seeking approval from women. Am I okay? And that, not to get too personal here, but that became using sex for approval, for a feeling of, oh, she approves me. She I'm okay with, like, I'm okay for her. She approves of me. She accepts me. It became this kind of, this signifier of being accepted, which is, in a way, a subtle form of objectification, of using women.
Sure.
To feel okay about myself. And boy, I hope I'm not alone, or in a way, I hope I am alone in this, but I suspect that I'm not alone in having done that.
I don't think it's a subtle form of objectification, honestly. I think hookup culture, I think the kind of male pickup artist game, I think that so much of this stuff, so much of the unhealthy, really unhealthy sexual masculine that we see in the culture is driven by that, is driven by, will you accept me as a man?
Right.
Will you approve of me as a man?
Yes.
And it's deeply addictive, deeply addictive quality of that is striving to get the acceptance of the feminine. And, you know, now we're speaking the feminine, the big feminine.
Right.
Within me, you know, within me, within you, within the culture. Yeah. And holy mackerel, you are not alone in that.
Yeah,
absolutely. I think that there's a large number of men, there's a large percentage of men who, like me and like you, made vows to ourselves as, you know, I was under 10 when this vow happened in me, that I would never be a man like that.
Yep.
And therefore, on some level, I will never be a man. And I think that that is the part of the cultural healing that I see a lot of men waking up to, and thankfully, gratefully, many, many women waking up to as well, that it's not okay, that this is how we are. And the natural thing that flows out of that is when men like me, like you, begin to heal that, then the ways in which I objectified women, the ways in which I held my sense of male privilege, the ways in which I felt entitled to women's bodies, to women's, to viewing women, to, you know, being the seer, all of those things have shifted.
Yeah.
And the women in my life, my wife first, are so, I respect and love and see my wife so much more clearly now that I have healed some of this wounding, so that I can feel, you know, so that my wife can feel empowered and pushed and challenged and supported by me in a way that would not have been possible when I was sitting in this vow of, I will never be that kind of man. I will never be a man.
Yes. So I think this is, I want to make sure everyone is really hearing this, that this I want to make sure I really heard it. That this constant seeking of approval or permission to be a man is generative of endless abuse of women. And that, because it's, and that when we can source our masculinity in a way that doesn't require constantly seeking the approval of women, then we will, and only then, will we truly treat women respectfully. So, I mean, it's kind of the opposite the way I was programmed, you know? It's the opposite, because the way I was programmed, the way I learned to be a man was constantly, what do I need to do to be acceptable? And how do I achieve this acceptable, you know, being, how do I achieve that? And what is a demonstration of that? It's really just like this whole elaborate way of using women for my cycle to source certain deep psychological needs. Like you said, or implied, they cannot be sourced that way. Anything is addictive when it appears to meet a need without really meeting the need. When you associate it with meeting the need and it doesn't meet the need. I mean, how much approval from women do I need before I feel truly empowered to be a man? No amount is enough. No matter how much I receive of that, I still want more. I need to get it from somewhere else. And that's why, to return back to the question that initiated this, maybe that's why doing men's work in men-only groups is important. Because there's no woman there who I can, who I'm going to constantly like tilt and color and spin everything I say in order to gain her approval.
Right. Right. And I can, thank you. I'm feeling into the fear also that comes, arises in many women that I speak to, and certainly in my wife early in our relationship, the fear that arises, if I let the men go off and do their thing, isn't that just going to reinforce all of this entitlement and horror and privilege and, you know, isn't it just going to reinforce all the things that I don't want to see? And, you know,
but it's the opposite. In,
yeah. It,
or it could
it,
be.
It could be. Yes. Because I'm not going to say it is, but it could be the opposite. And then the functional question, in service to what, why, you know, men going down to the man cave to put down a six pack and complain. Probably not going to get us the results we're looking for.
Right. I mean, certainly a lot of men-only organizations, you know, in the past were basically like breeding grounds for misogyny.
Yeah. You know?
But they don't have to be that way. And in the future, we can create them differently.
Yeah.
I want to. We've been going for a little over an hour, and I know you wanted we're hoping to keep this between 60 and 90 minutes. So let's open up the mics and see if anyone wants to raise their hand and add something to this, what has become a fairly intimate conversation. So to do that, you hit *6, your hand will be raised. And then you'll be in the queue, and we'll randomly pick someone.
While we're sitting with that, the other thing that popped up to me, Michael Kimmel, who I have a lot of respect for, American Men's Studies Association, he's a SUNY Stony Brook professor, he talks about masculinity as the thing that has to be proven all the time. And we've just been kind of speaking about it from, you know, relationship between men and women, as, you know, seeking approval And now flip that to men and men, and it becomes the, I have to prove my manhood. I have to prove my masculinity over and over and over. And the other thing that I found about, you know, conscious, self-aware men's work is that that need to prove my masculinity has diminished and diminished and diminished over time. And when that is not present, when I don't feel like I have to prove I'm a man to you, or to the other men that I run into, to the builder who just built our house, to the plumber, to the electrician, when I don't have to feel that I have to prove my manhood, the space opens for connection. The space opens for, you know, lack of defensiveness, lack of fight, lack of, you know, it's just so much easier to have relationship. And when I look at the gang violence in here in Springfield, the boys killing boys, you know, so much of it is because they have to, if they feel that, they have to prove their masculinity over and over and over.
In the next the next session, the people who I, Sabina Lichtenfels and Benjamin von Mendelssohn, they basically elaborate that into saying that you know, our entire civilization, our entire ecocidal civilization could be seen as just one enormous exercise in proving our masculinity.
Yeah.
You know, like I
totally go
along with
that.
Bigger tower, I'm going to dig a deeper mine, I'm going to, you know, like I'm going to show you I'm a man.
Yeah. So when did we think when did we think we could control it? And it being whatever it is, and when we believe as men that we can control it, hence our doom.
Okay, so we've got four people on the line here.
Awesome.
Let's have the first person.
My name is Graham Calder. I'm a permaculture teacher in northeastern Turtle Island, and I've been encountering this debate internally for many, many years. This whole concept of a new definition of masculine, and serendipitously through one of my conversations with a woman who attends feminine sacred women's circles all the time. Literally the day later, I heard this invitation to your program. So I'm really grateful that I have the opportunity to share in this development of the masculine with all of you. My biggest dilemma is that I'm seeking a leader. I'm seeking someone to follow. I'm seeking a path. And everyone seems to say, well, you're one of the only men that I know that asks these questions. So you need to create the group. You need to lead the group. So my concrete question is specifically, I know this is a beginning, this whole conversation, this whole course that we're taking is a series, but what can you give us a list of resources or handouts or workshop exercises that we could utilize in the creation of a sacred men's circle to begin? Because without structure, what I find when gathering with other men is that it tends to revert to what they're used to doing in these circles, even though they're there with a different intent. If we don't have the tools and the guidance and the whatever else it is, then it gets lost.
You know.
So, as someone who's going into facilitation,
Boyden can tell you about the Mankind Project, but I personally, I don't feel like I'm ready to facilitate men's groups. But some of the people that I am, that I've recorded conversations with, they're doing some of this work that just is so inspiring to me, and so you know this will, you'll get some of the you'll get some of it, you know, as we go through, and also I think this is like, I think a lot of the people on this course have experienced some of this work, and so I think this is a good question to maybe start a forum thread on. I'm going to share some of the, like, you know, I've been coming across more and more work. I'm going to be probably bringing more people. I don't know. This might extend past the 8 sessions originally, because I mean, as I get deeper into this, people are now reaching out to me and offering to be on to be guests and so what I'm saying is that your impulse that you need to find someone. You need to experience some of it first before you can just convene a men's circle. Like there are people out there who have been doing mind-blowing work in this for years or decades. Like, you got to get that transmission. That's, at least that's how I feel for myself. Like, I would not convene a workshop on this until I'd really experienced and integrated some of it.
Nice. Graham, can I ask you a question?
Yes, go ahead.
Where are you specifically?
I'm in Montreal, but I do a lot of projects in New Brunswick and Nova Scotia in Canada.
Yeah. Look out for Mark Morey, Institute for Natural. Yeah. Mark Morey travels around, does some of this work. Bill Plotkin, Animas Valley Institute. He's in the States in the Southwest. Permaculture there. Yeah. Forum, put it in the forum. There's some really great overlaps in the permaculture, nature awareness, movement building, men's work space. There's some really good stuff out there. And I totally echo what Charles said. Yeah. Get some downloads from people doing the work, and you're not alone.
Thanks.
Okay. Put someone else on the line.
Hi, my name's Kathy Kirk, and I just want to say this is really beneficial to me. I think to especially maybe the women who are doing all these sacred circles. I'm amazed to hear, and I appreciate you guys being so personal, that you seem to think you need approval from women. That just kind of blew my mind. But I'm also wanted to say that I'm in the process, and I know all women are, attempting to integrate their masculine self. And I have encountered tremendous resistance within my own being to do that, because I haven't had a really great example of what a divine masculine would look like. So I think this conversation is so timely, so needed, and not just for men. So I wanted to just thank you both, and I'm listening keenly. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Kathy.
Here, here. Yeah.
Okay, next person.
Hi, guys. My name is Jim Axling. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. And I guess I don't have, it's sort of a question, it's sort of a reflection of what I've been hearing thematically as we're talking here today, which is in the realm of, say, binaries, and like, what is the value of being, of separating out? In a sense, just by being in this world, we broke into binary. I mean, that's what the myths of the Taoism and the Hindu are pointing to, right? Is we're in this place of separation, and also feeling wholeness here. And as I'm, one of the things I'm finding myself really starting to awaken to is how afraid I've been of the conflict that can come up in that. You talked on the fellow had the question about parenting. That comment in the original conversation really struck me as well, about the idea of being able to be pushed on and make a safe place for somebody else to be different from me, in a sense. Like, I know what I'm doing, but why is my kid doing this other thing? And just allowing them the space to get out there and work it out for themselves. And I've had success of that and utter failure to that. And had to, you know, like, immediately go in and triage and go, okay, I see where I just fell down, and just reestablish being with that person. But so much of that, I think, is really, I'm discovering, has been complicated by this fear of conflict, of not engaging with how different we are along whatever binaries, you know, political or sexual or whatever. And so I'm really excited to be hearing, like, what is... In many ways, I'm just starting on I've been kind of preparing for this for a while, and I'm really looking forward to hearing more about what else we can do in embracing our own particular, like, we all have things that are, we have strengths with. How do we, you know, just finding those things. I mean, this is all very general, kind of. But I just encourage, I just want to make sure to encourage people, like, yeah, there's this is something we all struggle with as human beings, as embodied beings.
You know, sometimes I've noticed that my what I might call being sensitive or developing my feminine side or being nice, kind, is actually just trying to avoid conflict. And maybe there are times to avoid conflict, but the conflict doesn't necessarily go away just because you avoid it.
Exactly.
Spiritual bypass, right?
Yeah.
Being a nice guy is a spiritual bypass.
Right.
It's great. I love it, Jim. Thank you for bringing conflict. That is a lot of it for sure. Like getting comfortable with conflict and just affirming it without having to take one of the pre-written scripts that culture kind of provides us as men for what we're supposed to do in conflict, which is I'm supposed to punch you in the head or I'm supposed to run away. Right?
Yeah.
Those are my two options. So what if I just stand in the conflict?
Right.
It's revolutionary.
And how much of our unhealthy competition comes from not from thinking I have to win, I have to show this person he's wrong, or whatever that is, versus just engaging, hey, here's somebody who has a completely different experience. What happens if I just be present with this person? What if I, like, figure out a way to contain a world that has, you know, this person's viewpoint in it and my person, you know, my viewpoint in it.
You know, this is coming up in geopolitics right now. I was reading some more left-wing writer on, you know, why is it that we are so unwilling to look at history, the history behind terrorism, you know, so unwilling to look at the history of the Middle East that has generated this conflict, this anger, this violence.
Yeah.
I just don't understand it. You know, why are we so blind to history? And then later in the essay he said, actually, I do understand it. It's obvious because when we look at that history, we realize that we are complicit in creating that history. So this, you know, this is often the case in conflict too. Like, when it's not just about kind of, quote, holding space as this neutral observer, because if it all involves you, if, like, unless you're like some, you know, outside facilitator who's coming in, I mean, if it involves you, then uncomfortable things are going to come up.
Yeah. The juices will flow.
Yeah. Beautiful. That's awesome. Awesome.
So, and yet there's no real answer to it necessarily other than, there's going to be some conflict here. But there's going to be difference, you know, whatever. Maybe there's another word for it. But, I mean, in some sense, there can be, like, there's more positive, loving ways to be different with someone. That isn't conflictual.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up. But I want to respect the time that we stated.
Yeah. No, exactly. There's nothing to be done. Yeah. I just wanted to say it.
Thanks, Jim.
Boysen, I know that you have things that you need to do this afternoon. There are two more people on the line, however.
Jump. Go.
What would you like to do?
Let's take another and nobody's come banging on my door yet.
Okay.
So.
All right. Let's take another.
Hey, this is Morgan. I'm also in Portland, Jim, and thanks for taking the call. It's I've just been thinking about the like being in groups of men where I've been honored to actually in programs with Michael Mead, so I would add him to the list of Bill Plotkin and the others that the boys and you just mentioned doing some really good work, and just being, I just really resonate with like the being solid enough in the world, like what that feels like and what happens when we're solid enough to be in the conversations that you were just talking about, like the, you know, the geopolitical leaders of what if they could sit in the conflict. Because when I've been in that space and people bring really hard stuff, like really men bring really vulnerable, like all the stuff you guys are talking about, and it's just met with that solid, loving, not reactionary, but like we're big enough to hold this. And we can hold you in all the things you fucked up, you know, and all the mistakes you've made and all the like things you bring. And it's beautiful to be in a room when that kind of thing is happening. And I've actually, Graham, I too was in many years on a search for mentors. Being a 45-year-old guy, I felt alone for a long, long time in the world. And finally, actually, at Michael's retreats, found older men that I could would listen and would be there and would be solid enough to be role models for myself, so that I could be the role models for the young guys. That feels so important. I haven't done Mankind Project work, but I'm really intrigued by it and want to check it out.
You're here. Yeah. Thanks. Yes, Morgan. Michael Mead, definitely.
Yeah.
And let's just hold that in the space. Thank you for invoking that, just the feeling of being in that environment. I think
it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's important. Just to
and
know
I think
it
makes it safe for others. So I think when we're able to be in that space, it makes it, that makes it safe for other men and other people to actually step in and be themselves or explore it.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah, just knowing it exists is, you know, it speaks to something in me. Like, it feels good to know that that is possible. Let's have one more person here, and then we'll be, move on. Hello? Well, someone was on, but then they just disappeared. Okay, well, looks like an international person, Ardhan or something, but perhaps the call dropped. Anyway, okay, so maybe we'll wrap it up for now, unless this guy reappears. Yeah, this is getting good. And I'm really hoping and wanting that we're beginning to set the tone for what's to come. I felt like at the beginning of the call, I was kind of feeling around and just, but now that which wants to happen is happening, I believe. And I'm really grateful to have heard the voices coming through, and I think this is going to be really rich, especially with the provocations that we're going to be receiving from the next set of guests.
Great.
Who are going to be provocative. And I've recorded them. I've three more recorded already, and I'm going to be traveling next week to New Mexico and recording with Larry Littlebird, who's going to bring a totally other perspective, an indigenous perspective to it, to this conversation, and some other people too.
Excellent.
And so anyway, I want to thank you, boys, and thank you so much for catalyzing us at the beginning. And is there anything final you want to say before you sign off?
I love being on the phone with you, Charles, because one of the things that I love is that you really leave space in the conversation, and I love the silent spaces that have been in the conversation that have just let the next step happen. Yeah, based on that very last thing said, don't seek safety. You know, seek safety. Create safety, but don't seek comfort. That's what I want to leave with. Yeah, create safety, but don't seek comfort.
Thank you. And thank you to everybody else who, even if you haven't raised your hand, we're creating a presence, we're creating a gathering, and I'm starting to feel that gathered feeling and really, please accept my thanks and my gratitude for your participation. And as before, we will, the next episode, the next session will be coming online in a few days to a week. We'll announce it for you. This one has been recorded, so you can listen to it if there's any part you want to hear again. And so the next session will be a recorded session, and then we'll have another live session following that. So we're going to just unmute everybody so we can all say goodbye to each other. Until next time.
Your call is on hold. Please hold the line.
Goodbye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It was great.
Yep. Your call is on hold. Please hold the line.
Wonderful.
Wonderful.
Shut up.
Wonderful.
Next time.